Hi, everyone, and thank you for your attention. I am very fortunate to introduce our lunchtime speaker today. Let me start by saying we are live streaming this session, so greetings to all of you out on the web who are joining us. Welcome to NATOA. And a big welcome also to our lunchtime speaker, Milo Medin of Google. Milo's Vice President of Access Services at Google, and I'll talk a little bit more about his background in a minute, but I want to say not only thank you for being here, but also thank you for flying in, I think, very quickly from Orlando, where Milo was attending Google's Republican candidate debate last night, and made some rather superhuman efforts to be here with us today, and we are really grateful. I'll make the introduction quick at Milo's request, and you're going to want to hear from him more than me, believe me. But I'll just say that he is an extraordinary legend in the technology and internet community, and we are lucky to get his perspectives. His time at Google is likely to be quite fascinating because he is in charge of Google's fiber initiative as well as some of its wireless initiatives. But by way of background, I'll share just a couple of things with you. Milo was a scientist at NASA, an internet pioneer and visionary. He was the scientist who made feasible some of the early research-based prototypes of the internet and one of the earliest champions of TCP/IP and open internet standards, which, of course, were the foundation of the modern open commercial internet. Very appropriate and relevant to this community, Milo was also the founder of At Home and one of the people on both the technical and the business side who made the cable modem work. And cable modem networks are almost unimaginable without his contribution. And then more recent years, he was one of the visionaries behind M2Z, which is a very innovative wireless idea that the FCC unfortunately didn't quite see the insight behind. But he is now at Google, and we are looking forward to hearing about Google's initiatives and his perspectives on our future. Please welcome Milo Medin.
All right, it's nice to be here. Whoa, lots of audio. I grew up on a farm in the Central Valley, and I'm on a lavalier, right, so I don't need this. So I usually talk relatively loudly. My wife of 10 years has been cautioning me about talking so loudly, and I'm getting better at it. But in a forum like this, it helps. I'm going to talk about a few things. What I think of and how Google sees the problem around broadband speed in America. A little bit about the background of our program. Rick Witt talked earlier in this week about kind of how things started. I won't duplicate that too much. Kind of what we're looking for, what we'd like to see happen with the fiber initiative, where we're starting and how we're doing that. A number of folks here have asked about policies, how to make your communities more gigabit friendly. We've talked to a number of communities who have applied in our RFI, and so I'll try and share some of our insights for whatever that's worth. Talk about applications, a little status update, and then we'll conclude. I hope I'm not standing between you and dessert, but I... this is probably not news to people in this room, but broadband is not doing well in America. America used to be the leader in broadband. Joanne talked about my time at Home. I founded that company with John Doerr and the folks at Kleiner. In cooperation with the cable operators, we deployed the first, I think, kind of mass market residential broadband network service in the 90s. Our first production rollout was 15 years ago, 1996. Over in Fremont, California, just across the bay here. Does anybody remember what we charged 15 years ago? For $40 a month, you got about 4 or 5 megabits of download. Now, today, it's a decade and a half later. a decade and a half. And most people pay slightly more than $40 a month, and maybe you get 2 or 3x the download speed. That is, if you look at the price of long distance, which back in that day was something like 25 cents a minute, now it's so cheap, it's basically free, it's bundled in with everything. Cellular used to be about a buck a minute, maybe a little more back in those days. Now it's a fraction of that. A lot of telecom services have become much cheaper or much higher performance in 15 years. But we haven't seen those kind of step function increases in broadband. Well, okay, so that doesn't sound very good, but how do we compare to others? Well, in 2010, the OECD ranked the U.S. 29th out of 34 nations in terms of average advertised speed, 29 out of 34. But don't worry, we are a leader. We lead in terms of the average dollars per megabit of expense consumers pay. In fact, only consumers in Israel, Chile, and Mexico pay more per megabit than U.S. consumers do. And the result is that we rank 15th in penetration in broadband in among the OECD countries. So this is not a good report card. As the world moves to more and more of an information-based economy, speed, telecommunications infrastructure, these kind of facilities become critical to competitiveness. Speed becomes critical in terms of where new applications originate, where the next Google, where the next Netflix, where the next Amazon are developed. Google cares a lot about speed. We put enormous effort into making search and all our products go fast. You may have noticed a few months ago, we turned on this thing called Google Instant, where you, in your search, you just type a letter, and the system is automatically trying to complete and doing searches for every letter you type. The amount of infrastructure needed to make that change, right, is actually quite phenomenal. But we do it because it makes people more productive, right? It makes the service more popular. People have lots of choice in this area. And so we care a lot about speed. Half our revenues still come from North America. We're a U.S.-based company. We care a lot about American competitiveness. My colleague Rick Witt outlined the history of the fiber program, so I won't go into all those details. But let's just say, you know, Google has a fundamental bias towards action. People inside the company, it's like, why are you whining about this? Go do something about it, right? You can go to the regulators, you can go to the FCC, you can go to the government, but you know, what can we do about it? And that's what action can we take on behalf of the user? So the Google Fiber for Communities RFI was put together. And, you know, initially, I wasn't at Google at the time. People wondered whether or not anybody would actually really care. And 1,100 communities responded. This was just stunning to us. Internally to the company, people had no idea. I mean, because think about it. You had all these mayors, city council leaders, chambers of commerce, everybody's coming together saying, we want a gigabit in our community. In my conversations with people, people weren't talking about it because of some abstract techie term, right? They realize at maybe a fundamental level that it's about economic prosperity for their citizens, for the businesses in their area, their students, a leg up in educational competitiveness, and civic impact in terms of being able to disseminate information in brand new ways. So along the way, Google started wondering if this was more of an opportunity than just an experiment. Everyone seems to want better options, more choice. When I joined Google in December, we realigned the program And now we're moving ahead with deploying our gigabit access service as part of a new business unit inside Google. So that's the unit I run. I have a bunch of wireless initiatives as well as wireline. And they naturally complement each other. Beyond making money, and by the way, we do think we can make money. And I actually think making money is a good thing. It allows you to do more things. We want to move the needle significantly on access. 15 years ago in At Home, we took the web from kilobits to megabits. What we want to do is take the web now from megabits to gigabits. And we think we can do it. We think it's important. And we think more importantly, consumers want that. Users care about speed. Just out of curiosity, how many DSL lines do you think were added in the U.S. last year, in calendar year 2010? Take a guess. Anybody willing to guess? 50,000 added? 400,000 added? There were 800,000 DSL lines turned off in 2010. This is not, as Craig Boffett, an analyst for Bernstein Research, said, we're no longer seeing the obsolescence of a product, we're seeing the obsolescence of a network. People care about speed, and they vote with their pocketbooks to do that. We want gigabit service to be available on a broad basis. Very few people are going to be willing to pay 10 or 20 times what they pay today for gigabit speed. Demand is highly price elastic. So part of our focus is really about how we can lower costs for deployment and for service, and not just bet on applications that will provide more value for consumers and justify, you know, more of that, their disposable income. There's only so much disposable income out there. You're not going to get more than that. And so low costs are the key to being able to make the business work. Also, I want to say, and this is our particular bias, we're not trying to offer more of the same. What I mean by that is we're not trying to offer services that you can already get through DOCSIS 3. I helped write the DOCSIS spec. It's a very capable system. The HFC plan is a very capable network. But it has its limits. And the real purpose of fiber is to deliver services that exceed those limits. And gigabit service to the home is one of those sorts of services. Google has very cost-effective network infrastructure. If you think about it, right? How many of you here have ever clicked on a Google ad? Okay, well, you are paying for everybody else in the room's access to search, right? The point is, we can't spend much money doing what we do. Efficiency, low cost, is like one of the key drivers in how we think about infrastructure. Yes, it's very high performance. We carry massive amounts of data. But we do it, I don't think anybody moves bits cheaper than we do. And again, that helps us be able to offer services at lower prices and still offer a step function in speed. And by the way, this is a good business to be in. Wall Street analysts like Moffitt calculate the gross operating margins for the cable broadband service that you get today at roughly, you know, over 90%. In his Q2 report, Comcast, he calculated it at 93.2%. It's a good business to be in. And so that's part of the reason we're in this space. And I will also say we're not trying to solve all problems. There are a ton of problems, and no one company or one technology, one set of solutions works. Many of our problems stem from lack of adequate competition. The Fios rollout has kind of slowed down to a crawl. I saw an article recently that AT&T had announced that they were not building out a whole lot more U-verse. Telco investment in the wireline area has declined substantially, and they're investing in areas where they get higher return on their money. That's what shareholders would expect you to do. And by the way, I don't believe wireless is going to be an adequate substitute. You could have a 16 megabit LTE service, but if the volume cap on it is 2 gigabytes a month versus 250 gigabytes a month for a cable, the applications that and the way consumers use those products is going to be wholly different. So I don't think wireless can compete effectively, at least in terms of the kind of services that we see popular on wireline networks today, at least not with the current structures we see. Rural markets have special problems. Middle-mile fiber access is critical. There's even less competition in rural areas than there is in most of America. And there's heavy regulatory involvement, which is not always helpful. There's no silver bullet to fix it either. So there are many other efforts that are being taken by others to drive adoption, speed, and availability. I think of my friend Blair's GigU project, which is a great thing. All of these kind of efforts are needed to help solve the fundamental problems of broadband access in America and return America to a position of leadership. So let's talk about a little bit about how we're starting. After an extensive review process, we selected Kansas City, Kansas as our first market, and Kansas City, Missouri, just across the river, as our second. A lot of people have asked, why did we pick Kansas City, including people in Kansas City, by the way? And we viewed it as a very clear choice for our first deployment. Reardon in Kansas City, Kansas, is a great leader, and he and his staff know how to get things done. They can move quickly at Google speed, I think is what one of the quotes made. But part of the reason they can do that is, you know, they have this unique, this county and city government are integrated. It's a unified government. So they don't have to go through nearly as many steps as some communities do to deal with permitting or the kind of partnerships that we're talking about. The community there was greatly supportive, involving lots of groups and companies from across the region, and focused on taking what we will provide with this infrastructure and exploring it for innovation in all kinds of areas. In healthcare, the folks at KU Med Center have folks that are dedicated to now looking at how to use this network to do innovation in healthcare, in education, in entertainment. And, you know, very importantly, Kansas City has great infrastructure. The utility there, the BPU, has been a great partner with us. And we can't be more pleased with how the community has reached out to partner with us. It really is a great relationship. And we've worked with the leadership on the Missouri side as well. Mayor James, Councilwoman Serco, who helped put their proposal together. Many folks believe that if you don't have a muni utility, you don't have any ability to get anything interesting done. That isn't true. Mike Chester, the CEO of Kansas City Power and Light, which is an investor-owned utility, has been a great supporter. We worked out a pole attachment agreement with him. And they're, they are very progressive. It takes leadership. I will say, when we first started interacting, it was like, well, so are you Title II or Title VI? And we're like, well, we're Title I. Well, Title II, Title VI. No, we're Title I. And we had all these odd requests. The way Mike tells the story, they were trying to figure out what to do with all this when he was talking to his 26-year-old son. And he told him about Google and some of the conversations. And his son said, Dad, it's a gigabit. You got to make it happen. And he said, yeah, but you know, what do they know about the plan? Dad, it's a gigabit. You have to make it happen. You can't just like, you got to make it happen. He said, really kind of opened his eyes. And they're great partners of ours in this effort. So I would say if you have a muni utility, that's great. If there's an investor-owned utility, it's all about leadership. It's all about leadership and vision and seeing what the impact is to the community. Several folks have asked about, why we like what policies does Kansas City have that made it easier for us to work with them. Let me just say, we didn't ask for or receive any special tax benefits or financial incentives to go to either of these two cities. In fact, we asked for something much, much harder from them. Much, much harder. We wanted them to streamline processes. And it is actually easier to get tax breaks and financial incentives and actually change the way process works in rights of way and permitting and the rest. It's non-trivial. Few data points. The dominant cost of in a fiber build is labor. Should not be a surprise to you. So maximizing the efficiency of that labor is absolutely critical. So one of the things we ask for is I want dedicated inspectors from the city that are dedicated to this project. So the labor in the field, as they're constructing, never has to stop waiting for an inspection. That shaves 4 to 5% of the cost of a build. Just that one thing. We will have people co-located with local government offices. So if there's an exception to permitting or some issue, it's not the usual telephone tag, get back, they walk across the hall and we can resolve it quickly. It's all about efficiency, driving down the cost of deployment, making processes be more streamlined. Standardized intervals for make readies and other access to poles that where we can get much less variation in time to construct, and so that we can plan things out and not have to have as much labor waiting, right? The area is roughly 70% aerial. On the Kansas side, there's conduit that goes to about 30%, not the laterals, but down the streets. That helps us. Anytime you've got conduit, it is just great. We don't have to tear the streets up. We don't have to go through permitting structures to deal with that. Access to the electrical supply space. So we can use dielectric-coated fiber, so we don't necessarily have to wait for the communication space to be cleared. Again, it's all about process improvement. I know you're disappointed. You wanted, I've got some really cheap laser, or I've got some robot that buries, itself and just goes off. There's no silver bullet. Right? Now, we haven't found it yet. We do have people working on these kind of things, right? But I have to say, there's the low-hanging fruit is all about process improvement. Now, we're also providing connectivity to government offices and schools and libraries as we build. And so there's a whole host of items that we're collaborating with the community on. But I think these are things that really matter, right? And many of you here have influence on these processes. So I would say think about them from the context of somebody building a new network. There are other elements, of course, that make the Kansas City area a great choice. Both Kansas and Missouri are very business-friendly states. We have dark fiber access. If you're really serious about a gigabit, you need dark fiber transport because you're going to put your own optics on it. And we've got that access in this region. We don't have people trying to make money on access to rights of way, which I feel is basically a tax. There's some communities If they're in the process of undergrounding, there's moratoriums placed on access to poles. So you can't build in on the pole until the underground project happens, right? All of these things are big disincentives. And, you know, I'll just highlight one thing since we're here in the home state of California. You know, one of the things when we were looking at permitting and all of these process issues, you know, we eliminated every city in the state of California because of CEQA, which is the California Environmental Quality Act, which was sad. There were a number of cities here which were doing great things, very creative things in their proposals. I'll just dig into this a little bit to give you some specifics, right? CEQA has some issues, right? The agency lead, which can be different in different projects and different communities, has to decide, quote, if there is no possibility of significant environmental impact of a project. If they decide that, then you can go through an abbreviated process. If they don't, it's this long, drawn-out, complicated EIR mess. However, the legislation that created this didn't define what the word significant meant. So what happens? Somebody says, well, I don't want this to happen. No possibility of significant, right? Well, this is just an invitation for litigation, which adds all kinds of variability and delay. The fear of this litigation, in fact, drives a whole lot of issues in how people deal with CEQA. And, you know, people are nodding in the room, right? This is, like, well known. But it's not fixed. Ambiguity and uncertainty poison the climate for investment. And capital will go elsewhere. And that, unfortunately, that's what happened here where we looked at the proposals from here in the state of California. Google's a green company. We deeply care about the environment. But there's productive ways of protecting it and other ways that are vague and generate a lot of ambiguity in the system, which is not good. We also had a bunch of other interesting problems. So, for example, the FCC just did a pole attachment proceeding. And they did not extend pole attachment rights to Title I operators. So that meant there's no... I don't have the right to attach to poles. So I have to strike individual agreements and negotiate those things separately. It's almost like the FCC wants me to become a cable operator, right? And I don't think they do. But it is interesting, right, that pure ISPs, pure information service providers, you know, you don't have the right to attach to poles. And for many of the innovative people who want to work in your communities to do innovative projects in non-standard ways, this is an important issue. And yet they don't have any right. Now, that doesn't mean you can't attach the pole. It's just we have two pole attachment agreements in the Kansas City area with KCPL and BPU. It just meant we had to negotiate it separately. There's no right. And they could say no. And, you know, cities and states should be laying conduit any time a right-of-way is open, right? I mean, is this like a no-brainer or what? You can save enormous amounts of cost and inconvenience. People really hate it when the streets are cut up, right, and traffic has to be diverted, et cetera. And Eshoo, who is a congressman who represents the district that Google is in, has had a bill drafted and proposed... that would require conduit be laid for all federal highway projects. Things never gotten an opportunity to get voted on. Yeah, totally common sense, right? Sewer projects, water projects, any kind of right-of-way is being constructed, conduit should be laid. Why is it that we can't do these things? Right? This is just common sense. Let's see. One last thing I want to address about policy. Google does not think is a good idea for states or the federal government to ban municipalities from constructing networks. Now, let me just say, it's not that we believe that muni fiber networks are always the right thing to do. I don't think that's the case. I don't know too many local leaders who actually really want to get into that business. But here's the thing. If a muni network runs into problems, the local residents have to own up to it, either through tax assessments or other fees. They hold their leaders accountable. There's a level of accountability at the local level that exists that does not exist at the state and federal level. People point to projects like Burlington, Vermont, right? Of projects that have real problems. But that actually proves the point. The local press, there are just like running stories all the time about it. The citizens there are up in arms. People are, you know, the politicians are being held accountable for their mistakes. That's the way the system's supposed to work. I will tell you, I've seen tons of federal projects that have been mismanaged to the tune of thousands of times more money, and there's no accountability that's being held there. Local accountability is a great thing. Local people generally know better than the states or the federal government. And so because of that, we just don't think it's a good idea to unilaterally ban it. I just think that just doesn't make any sense. People are held accountable at the local level way more effectively. Trust people to make the right decision. If they make a mistake, they pay for the consequences. And if it works out really well, they enjoy the benefits too. What's wrong with that? Should be the way it works. Let's talk about applications for a little bit. Many people ask us, what applications exist that can actually use a real gigabit? Not like a pseudo gigabit, you know. Gigabit with water added, right? So there aren't really any today. But that doesn't mean it's not useful. 15 years ago, I remember we were deploying cable modem service, right? The web was all 56K dial-up based. And we were turning on the service, it was 4 or 5 megabits of download. And people said, what could people use that for? There's no application out there that can use that kind of capacity. Certainly not in people's homes. Their whole SyncPak fleet at the time was connected by a T1 line. Okay? I mean, if you think about it, right? And in fact, we tried to talk to AOL about having AOL sell cable modem access to their subscribers, right? Bundling it together. We thought it was a great idea. They surveyed their customers with questions like, would you pay double your dial-up charges to download your email 100 times faster? Now, oh, sure, you laugh now, right? You laugh now, but back then, right? It's like, well, what do you use it for? Well, you're just going to do what you're doing right now. I'm going to download my email 100 times faster. Well, sure, it'll do that. But that, of course, is the wrong question. It was hard to foresee services like YouTube and Netflix, services that wouldn't exist without broadband. Cloud-based services that we all take for granted today depend on broadband connectivity at these kinds of speeds and are enhanced by faster access. We think people will use it initially to do what they did before, but just on a lot less time. And you know what? There are multiple devices in the home now. Many of these devices can generate tens, if not hundreds, of megabits of demand. That can just swamp your existing connections. Now, wouldn't it be nice that you could actually share with the kids and they could be all running their bandwidth-intensive apps and hey, stop that! I'm trying to watch a YouTube, right? our first installed test user at Stanford decided he'd buy a movie on iTunes. I forget what the movie was. I think it was a chick flick. Maybe not. And iTunes told him it would take him 2.5 hours to download. He started it, and it was done in less than 5 minutes. And he was like, whoa! Do you think his behavior on how he buys media will change because of that? Being connected to the cloud at high upload speeds makes remote access seem local, right? Your standard SATA hard drive, right? If you run it at, if you do a sequential read off of it, it'll run at about 100 megabytes a second. Well, guess what? The cloud can now read that at full speed if you have a gigabit uplink. Isn't that cool? What could that do in terms of backup, in terms of all kinds of different ways of sharing information? And, you know, look, we're working with partners on the development of new sets of apps that can use a gigabit in healthcare, education, entertainment. But fundamentally, the network is a platform for others to use to deliver new services. And this is very consistent with how Google views its business. We're a platform that empowers users to search, empowers users to access information, empowers users and advertisers to meet. We really build platforms. So it's very consistent in that way. So where are we? On the Kansas side, we've completed the kind of macro engineering of, you know, the where the OLT sites go and the spine that connects them back to long haul, and the detailed engineering all the way down to the LCPs, what home, where the NAPs go, all this kind of stuff. And we'll begin construction in November. And we hope to be able to offer service and turn up the first set of customers in Q1 of next year. So we're still pretty much on track there. We're still in the macro engineering phase in the Missouri side. It's a bigger market. Rights of way are a little bit more complex there. And so we think it'll lag by one or two quarters, lag Kansas by one or two quarters. We're also talking to other communities inside the Kansas City DMA and outside the region about future deployments. Because you know what? People still say they want a gigabit. Just because we said we're going to deploy in Kansas City first didn't mean that people stop wanting their service. And by the way, we're hiring. I just want to put out mention this. Google as a company is on track to hire something like 5,000 people this year. And I still have 100 open positions in my group alone. So, jobs.google.com. You know, the folks in, I just want to conclude by saying a few things. The folks in Kansas City have really welcomed us in lots of ways. We're working hard to be good neighbors to them and give new choices to consumers, choices that they just didn't have before in terms of internet access. As with any pioneering effort, we're going to make mistakes. So let me just say, expect mistakes. But I'm hoping we'll make new mistakes instead of old mistakes. I made a bunch of old mistakes before, and now I hope we can avoid some of those. Many of you here have key roles in setting policies that can make your communities more gigabit friendly. So that we or another company, or maybe even the city, could come in and offer a service like what we're going to deliver in Kansas City. You know, we're going to try and be helpful here in policy settings and conversations. You never know what may happen in the future. But the funny part is I talk to many people here and in cities about these kind of process issues. People know what they are. They already know them. So I'm like, my exhortation to you all is, if you see a problem, go out and fix it. Don't wait for a conversation with Google or some other catalyst to go do it. Because you're going to make your city gigabit friendly in the process of doing so. Sooner or later, this kind of network, even in the United States, will be deployed on a more pervasive basis. Sooner or later. And how friendly your community is to these kind of deployments affects, you know, kind of where you're going to get fit into that. I'd also suggest thinking about how a new entrant can come in is different than how an incumbent is, you know, dealt with, right? By and large, incumbents have networks that are already built. So they care less about issues about involving new construction, whereas a new entrant is all about pole attachment, access, being able to go do that. And we don't have the existing customer base and revenue stream, right, to deal with a whole lot of process overhead, right? This is a space where most people are already connected. There's a line, Genghis Khan, I think, had a quote that said, you know, winning is not enough. Others must lose. So in some ways, this is about market share, right? These systems come in and you're generating competition. That's a good thing. Competition is what powers America. And we think more of it is good. Giving consumers more choices is always a good thing. And, you know, you guys here have the ability to empower your citizens to have more choices. That's a good thing. And so we want to partner with you to help make that happen. Thank you. I think we have Q&A, right? Sorry. Any questions? Joanne, you get to decide. Whoever gets the mic. Okay.
This is Tony Perez with Seattle. You mentioned on the process improvements to permitting, mm-hmm. construction costs, and so forth. Generally, it's the figure I hear, it's about 70% of the cost of building a network is involved in the public works and the building out. Mm-hmm. And you hear figures of anywhere from $800 to $1,000 to pass, mm-hmm. per home. And so what are your expectations in Kansas City? Maybe not so much in the the percentage, how you can bring down the percentage of the public works from 70%. What figure are you looking at?
Well, part of it is we picked a market where and a set of partnerships where we felt that we could get the numbers down lower, right, than what you would typically find to begin with, right? We just didn't consider markets which were really high cost or very high touch, at least not for this go around. And I think, you know, if you think about items like the inspectors, et cetera, it's a few percent here, here, and here. It's not cutting the cost by 90%. You don't get that, right? But you can make a big difference over what, and it's really dependent on the particular community. The difference between underground and aerial drives costs significantly. Distance, you know, density, how long the laterals are to connect up, you know, drops and the rest. Obviously, some of that's done when you're connecting a user as opposed to doing the build going down the street. So I can't give you a number off the top of my head. I will tell you, you know, it affects, you know, anything you can do to reduce that cost. And if you can shave 20%, of the cost by process improvements, which I think you could probably do in most areas, I think that's a significant figure.
Hi, Milo, David Olson from the city of Portland, Oregon.
Hi.
Nice to see you.
Thanks.
And I'd be happy to take out my eye teeth now if we get on your list for subsequent deployments. In any event, a couple of questions. I had the honor, pleasure of going through the Hong Kong broadband network in June, meeting with the CFO and the regulatory office there, and the impression it made on me was it turned all the economics on its head. It was turned on its head. It's not just density. You might think it is, but it's not. Yeah. And I assume Google has a team out there or has already gone through it, but they're selling gigabit, symmetrical gigabit broadband for $25 a month now, and they're going to be in the black this year. One of the reasons is 7-8 year payback. Nobody in the USA thinks about that, but they're going to be in the black. They're going to be the dominant provider, and they do everything possible to drive down the cost of deployment every day.
Right.
There's nothing anybody there does but bring down the cost of deployment in every possible way. They don't even have truck rolls. They call them man rolls, other kinds of things. And I just am wondering why. They laughed at me about who needs the gigabit, because the answer is, as you said, we all do and will. But I wonder why Google is the only thing even close to having a vision like that in the USA, even close, and why the economies of scope and scale are not sinking in anywhere here about what that can mean in terms of broadband deployment to the masses. I mean, $25 a month gigabit symmetrical is quite different from $350 a month for the same thing in Chattanooga, and they were horrified. They said, do you think anybody's going to do that? The answer, we don't think so. I wonder why Google's the only one in the USA with their eye on the ball.
That is one of those, just one of these questions where somebody is designed to like hit, it's a softball, right? I think part of it is where there's a lack of competition, there's not the urgency to innovate. And that's just the way it is. If you've got a business that works and generates good margins, and you're not really under threat, your subs aren't being picked off, there's not that sense of, I have to do something. Everybody has programs to improve their networks and to drive for scale and the rest, but part of that is just comes from the nature of the competitive market. I would also say, in the at-home days, one of the things we did was we said, what does the price have to be? And then we reverse engineered cost all the way back. You design a network very differently if you're going that way. There is a tendency to say, well, I'm already in this business. Here's what I already charge. What can I do to get an incremental 20, 30, 40% improvement? But that's not changing the fundamental cost structures that you have in your own system. When you say, I have a target, I'm going to have to meet that, and I have to reverse engineer all that, some of the equipment you use, some of the design practices you use, some of that stuff just doesn't work anymore. We have the luxury of not having a legacy infrastructure. So we don't have a cost basis on access that basically says, I can't do this because it competes with this existing service or et cetera, right? It's just the, in some ways, new entrants have to do this. If you don't, you don't ever get financed. You never move forward with a plan. And part of it is Google is willing to make long-term investments. People joke around the self-driving cars. You've seen that, right? And people are like, oh, this is like all these, funny people in Mountain View. In 50 years, do you think cars will be driven the same way they are today? What about 25? What about 10? I don't know, right? If you're thinking long term, it's not like these are large investments, but the point is, you think long term. You think about where technology is going, how consumers can benefit from it, and you want to be an enabler for that. And, Google is just an odd company that way. It's part of the nature of our founders and the leadership team. People are willing to think long-term about that. And that's part of our DNA.
I'm actually going to take the liberty of asking a question, and then Jeff's next. Sorry. Sorry.
You have the mic. I did say you get to decide to ask.
Can I ask you about your comment about cable systems and HFC, and it's a very capable network, obviously. The policy discussion in Washington around speed for so long has been that there's a consensus for the most part in Washington that cable networks are going to meet all the needs we ever have, and that DOCSIS 3 and what comes after is way more than we need, and it's going to be well ahead of our needs going forward. And we can the fact that we have cable built out through most of the United States means that we don't have to think about the fact that the rest of the world is building fiber to the home. Obviously, Google's taken a slightly different approach. You were instrumental in building the early cable networks and operating them. What are your thoughts on the idea that cable is going to meet most of our needs?
Depends on what your needs are. And it depends on what you mean by cable. I used to work at Livermore Lab, working on nuclear weapons design. Is actually great preparation for competing with incumbents, by the way. That's a joke. That's a joke for those watching on TV. That was a joke. But at what Livermore, one of my supervisors once said, I don't know what language I'll be programming in 5 years, but it'll be called Fortran. And the point is, a lot of times we think about, we use the same word when the technology changes, right? Cable used to not have a lot of fiber in it. It has a lot more fiber in it today. There's still some systems in the U.S. that don't, that haven't upgraded. There's some that don't have DOCSIS 3. Part of the issues is, you know, how you deal with video, which most of the capacity and cable systems still assign to video. But, you know, let me just say about, that's a question you should address to Rochelle or some of the folks here from Comcast. I think we have gone a long time without a step function increase in performance. And by the way, I do not believe, if you say the self-driving car comment, I don't necessarily believe a gigabit will be adequate. In a long enough time horizon, it's not, now I'm in the self-driving car game, right? But I think the issue is, if you think about speed of computers, storage, all of the infrastructure that we use, communications tends to lag behind it. When we did a step function increase going to cable modems from dial-up, the computers had, you know, been making a lot of strides and could certainly use that connectivity. And in the intervening 15 years, right? Computers have gotten way more powerful. Virtually any commodity computer today can saturate a gigabit. So we're just catching up to what the actual computational systems can do. We're not actually going that far ahead of it. We're just catching up. And so the question is, one of the nice things about fiber is at least there's the potential for being able to move a lot of data, right? We think about these things at Google. So I'm going to be a little evasive. Thanks.
Jeff was next.
Yeah, just a quick question about the success of this project, and without having you give us any more earth-shattering news about the future, but, you know, looking at this project and then saying, is there a future, I guess is the question, for, you know, continued rollout by you?
So I will say officially, the company, when the RFI was kicked off, said that we would build one community between 50 and 500,000 people. The program has been expanded since then. But I'm not going to make any comments about steps, et cetera. You know, right now we're very focused on Kansas City, and it's a great community. We're working with them. They're great partners. We hope to learn a lot that can be applied in other places and by other people, by the way. This is not a situation where Google thinks it has to do this everywhere. It is interesting that people aren't thinking about these kind of systems on a broader basis, which is unfortunate. And I think, again, it goes back to what can you do about lowering cost? Cost is the driver in these networks. Any other questions?
First, terrific comments, and thanks for taking the time to be here.
Sure.
One thing that strikes me, though, is we actually have, and this is an overstatement, but we actually have 1 gig systems pretty much in passing 95% of the homes of the country today. I mean, the cable systems do have bandwidth that is between 750 and 750 megahertz up to 1 gig. The cable operators have made a business judgment about how to allocate that bandwidth,
sure.
And they've choked down the amount of bandwidth that's available for internet access or for wandering over the internet. My question is, when you think about the Kansas City model, how is Google going to deal with the video service demand of the consumers? Have you thought through the business model on how you're going to deliver video, and particularly given the contractual structure of the video industry and why cable has put itself together the way it has?
I mean, if there's another word that means something very different today than it did 5 years ago with video, right? What do you mean by video? I think I'll just say part of what we're doing is actually, I won't say brilliant, it's not brilliant. We're just talking to people in the community and asking them, what is it that you would actually like us to offer you? As opposed to presupposing that we know what they want. I know it's like seems silly, right? But we're talking to folks, and that's helping shape some of our thinking in this way. I think, you know, over time, there's no question that how video is consumed on the net will change. And the industry, I think, understands that. Just exactly what that means and how that path will get there, nobody really knows. I don't know either. So we're talking to the community. We're talking to folks about what kind of services they would like, thinking about how to meet the needs of the user in ways that delight them. And, you know, Google really is, I mean, it sounds like a line, but it's really drilled into employees. Think about the user. What can we do to give the user more choice, more capability, more power, empowering them to make better decisions, right? More information. And so part of that goes back to why we're talking to folks in the market.
Milo, thanks again for being here. When you talk about lowering costs, a lot of heads are nodding. We get that. But I want to ask you if you either personally or if Google has any thoughts on how do we get gigabit communities in small rural towns in America where there may be absolutely no rights-of-way permitting costs. There are communities in my state where the costs of trenching are pretty low because a lot of the streets haven't been paved yet. So it can't only be about lowering the costs. How do we get gigabit connectivity to rural America?
There are a bunch of projects in rural areas that have been, you know, even some of the small rural operators have done some very creative things. So it's kind of hit and miss. Generally, you see advanced systems and technology innovation in areas where you have competition, because competition forces that. In rural areas where there isn't competition, what are you going to do if you don't like the DSL? I mean, satellite? I mean, okay, have fun. So I think part of the dynamic there is still the same. It's sort of why would you deploy capital? Why would you invest in doing that? One of the big issues, and this has been flagged by multiple people, the National Broadband Plan, by NTIA, et cetera, is the issue of intra-LATA facility, right? How you get from long haul to these communities. And this is an area where you have small cable operators or small LECs that may not actually have the ability to transport cost-effectively back to inter-exchange. Back to the long-haul network and do it in a way that you could deliver a gigabit, right? But cost is also an issue of equipment, and sometimes that goes to scale, right? And architectures. You've got to have, you know, people and operations and all of those kind of things. And so the question is, if you try and replicate all that at scale, how does it work in that area, right? So all these factors go into that. But I don't think that there's any, you know, the pockets, the small communities that are dense, there's no reason why gigabit networks can't work there. Going beyond that, out to the farms is a different animal. I grew up on a farm in this, 20 acres in the Central Valley. I didn't have cable TV. I don't think it harmed my education, actually, by not having that at that time. But if I didn't have internet today, growing up on a farm, that was a very different animal. It's a very different problem. And so I think the challenge is really how to be creative about that, but also keeping it in perspective, right? We have a bunch of people who don't have broadband at all in urban areas, and the issue there isn't an issue of cost or availability. I mean, it isn't an issue of availability. It's primarily an issue of cost, right? If you look at the bottom 40% of American households today, the level of disposable income they have is very low, and because this the economic issues and that causes an issue. Are you going to pay for broadband if it means missing a meal? And so there's a bunch of problems, and they all need to be addressed. And so I don't think it's one or the other. We should try and work on all these things in parallel.
And I think we have time for one more question. Anybody else? You're kidding.
Great.
Oh, here we go.
We're nearly there.
All right.
I'm Brenda Cooper. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the City of Kirkland.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a cloud provider. One of the things that's slowed us down in adopting cloud is worry about whether or not there's enough broadband.
Mm-hmm.
So, A, thank you, because at least this helps drive that.
We have made that connection ourselves, by the way.
I assumed that you had made that
right.
connection.
Right.
My question is actually, do you see other people who also provide internet services or cloud services beginning to make that connection?
I don't like to speak for other people. I think, you know, part of the, everybody has to kind of decide what they want to be when they grow up, right? Where you want to put your emphasis, what do you want to focus on, what products and services you want to offer. Google has this really unrelenting focus on speed. I mean, the amount of engineering time that goes into shaving 100 milliseconds off of response of a system, I mean, you would be surprised, right? Because it's all about speed and access. And other people can differentiate in different ways, but that's part of our DNA. I do think, though, if you go back to the OECD numbers I gave, that's a big problem. And if we cease being competitive, if our citizens continue to pay way more, well, I guess if you're in Mexico or Israel or Chile, your U.S. is still better off. It's a problem because our competition isn't just between Silicon Valley and Washington State. It's between the United States and Hong Kong, who sells gigabit access for $25 a month. And it used to be that jobs were much more tied to physical assets and physical facility and locality. That is less and less true now. The same technology that allows people to telecommute and allows the cloud to move information around, that once it's in the cloud, it can be accessed anywhere easily. So in some ways, you know, these are broader trends that are happening. And I think, again, we looked at it and said, let's not complain about it, let's do something about it. Thank you.
Thank you.